and you reel, and I didn't expect Mr. Nealon to come in. I had this new reel. It's already been a visit this morning, Saturday morning, the 3rd of October, 1970, beginning of a new reel, Channel 1 Right. I didn't expect Mr. Nealon to come in. I didn't have anything planned, not one thing, and that was my mistake. And once he got here, I knew it was a mistake. I could have set something up, but it didn't. Channel 1 Right. A new reel. Mr. Nealon came in for a little short visit. He was due in town this Saturday morning, the 3rd of October, 1970. Mr. Nealon's visit, he came in the big kitchen. We talked a little bit, about three-quarters of an hour, maybe a little more. This Saturday morning, the 3rd of October, 1970, Channel 1 Right, a new reel. I didn't plan on taping Mr. Nealon or any of the Audubon people. Now that's what Miss Guthrie, she lives over there right where the River Six Road goes into that Cross Creek
Road.
Yeah. She's been there. Mr. Guthrie, I don't know how long she married. She just a little girl when she married him. He'd already had a family.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been there, way on back. And he lived until the last few years. He's 90 years old. And they had some land of their own, but mostly they paid this pasture rent, they call it, to the Container Corporation, Illinois, whatever it is. And she said now that there's nothing in that farm to eat. The only thing they get out there now is what they get along the lake.
Yeah.
But she said, they burn it off and everything.
Yeah,
but she said in the old days, the animals stayed in good shape winter and summer, and Mr. Guthrie butchered the year round, and he never fertilized or fed.
Well, he had a good range for summer and winter. But he had to burn the wood too if he had wild grass. And I came down here in 1910. That was done religiously in the flatwoods and most of the range country.
Yeah.
But the continued burning is hard on the soil.
Yeah.
You know, a tree during its lifetime and after returns everything to the soil that made it and precisely the material that it needed to grow with. But when man comes and burns off the cover, our piney woods, it's been determined that if it's a full stand of pines and not burned for 20 years, accumulate on the soil 20 to 27 tons per acre of leaf mold and humus. And that replaces what the tree uses for growth in large part. But then when the tree finally dies and falls down, the rotting wood replaces the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Now when you burn that off, you do two bad things. First, you reduce the humus content. And sand, Florida sand, 100 pounds of Florida sand, when thoroughly saturated, and the water will stand on top if you put any more with it. It will hold only 25 pounds of water, 100 pounds of sand. But 100 pounds of humus will hold 200 pounds of water.
Oh.
And there's your drought and flood control.
Oh.
Nature provides for it, but man destroys.
Yeah.
But you tell the foresters that, and they scoff, and they burn, and they control the burn. It hurts the soil. And when you hurt the soil, what does it say? Man owes everything on this green earth on 6 inches of good topsoil plus rain.
Yeah.
And when you destroy the productive capacity of the soil, you're hurting your timber.
Yeah.
But that's something wasn't in the book. Don't want to hear it.
Yes, sir. Unless they got a sort of a manual to go by.
If it doesn't on page 47 in the book, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And if I say so, 99% discounted immediately because I said so. And that's where they're wrong, too. I'm wrong, too. I'm not always right. Yeah. I know that.
Yeah.
So I can find some others who can go wrong.
Well, Miss Needle, let me tell you. It looks like them young fellas would just love for you to come around and listen to you talk.
Well, they hate to admit it. You don't know how tight the forestry fraternity is. When I lived back in Flagler County as a county agent, I organized the first forestry clubs in Florida, 4-H, and promoted it, and had to write to Washington, D.C. for instruction books. But I studied the woods, and finally in 1928, the State Forest Service came, and I made a talk here before the faculty club in 1915 about the need. If you'd asked me when I was 11 years old, I'd want to be a forester, but no school's available. One in Yale, how's a country boy that's poor going to get there? You know? So I had to take agriculture. But the faculty thought, I'm sure their speaker conked out on them, and they were hard up for someone to talk, so they called on me. But they thought I was touching the head, protecting the woods. We've always had plenty and we're always well.
Yeah.
And that attitude is what they said when the last buffalo was shot, too.
Yeah.
So I've been a conservationist, just born that way. I don't like to see nature disturbed. Well, the nature has preserved everything under natural conditions that Mother Nature needs.
Yeah.
And when we go in there and destroy one species or another, we upset the balance, but it wasn't in the book. So it doesn't matter if I say so or not. It's like that's condemned.
Well, now, they look at the book, these young fellas in the forest business, they look at the book, and they don't pay too much attention to what's out there growing, do they?
I had one young forester who joined our crowd and went to the woods with us, and He was a quiet boy, but I noticed he always stuck beside me. We'd occasionally talk about trees, and I said, "What are you studying?" He said, "Forestry." Well, I said, "If you expect to get a job with the universities or the government, you better get your PhD first, as soon as you can." "Nope," he says. "I get my bachelor's, I'm going out in the woods and get a job and find out what this is all about." Now,
really?
You have a promising young fellow.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You mean you really run into somebody like that?
Oh, that's the only one I ever run. But I said to myself, there's a promising young fellow.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to know only what's in the book. Well, here lately I've come up in the world. It's like a whole bottom rail.
Guys?
Yes.
We thank you.
Joel, let
Enjoy.
Me tell you, it's a great pleasure if you all come out here.
Well,
yes. We'll be in next
all
next
the thank Dr. Little for his interest in promotion, and we need lawyers in this promotional of conservation of natural resources.
You tell Ms. Nealon.
You're outstanding.
You tell Ms. Nealon, we're looking forward to seeing her sometime.
We hope to get there. She stays
we'll
in
see
busy.
You in a couple of weeks.
Okay. We'll remember that.
Yeah.
Bye now.
Bye.
You got it in fire?
Oh, no, I have some. I forgot where I was.
There's one boy that you run across who had a who was willing to get his first degree and then go out and learn a little bit
and get down to cases.
Yeah, get down to cases.
And that is what we need.
Thank you very much,
Doctor. It's been a pleasure, Lucia.
You know. I've come up in the world lately for no reason at all that I am involved.
Yeah.
But, you know, the newspaper people sometimes get hard up for a story.
Yeah.
And they get money for that.
Yeah.
One of them came up to me and said, "I want to go out to that forest with you. I want to look at it." After he looked at it and I explained what I was doing, lo and behold, the Flora Growing Ranch is a principal agriculture paper in Florida, and he had a story with pictures in there on my hardwood planting. The professors there have scorned it for 14 years, ever since I started. It doesn't exist. Well, when that came out in the Florida Grower, the Times Union reporter called on me, and he said, I'd like to see that. He saw that in the drawer, I think. And he got a story on in the Times Union on my hardwood plant. It's the only one in the state and the only one in the United States that's mixed and randomized. Why? That's my own idea. I could be wrong, but if I say so, it's always wrong. But if I can show them, then they can't very well object, because there it is and you can see it. So he put in a good story. Then the Florida Forestry Association, I didn't know about it because it don't belong any longer. It belonged to too many things, they can't keep up with them. So they get out a little news bulletin too. And lo and behold, they had to be at the top of the list of the people they were describing. And he says, here's a forester that doesn't believe what's in the books till he goes out and tries it.
Is that right?
I don't know who wrote it. I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
Somebody must have told him something. I don't know. I guess my detailed annual report might have gotten around, and I was trying to prove some things. Why did I mix them from here to Canada? Hardwoods always grow and make stands.
Yeah.
Well, you suppose in a million years Mother Nature might have learned something. So there is a mixed randomized planting of 16 principal species, some of them new, like the Asiatic chestnut, which is a promising tree there. Boy, 7 years you begin to get chestnut. And water tupelo, because it slopes down to wet ground. They said they'd give me the land, but not one penny for what I wanted to do with it. And I said, well, that's understood. And they lived up to the agreement to the letter so far. But there must have been some talk about me in the Florida Forestry Association, because they called me up in Tallahassee and said, you must be at the Ponstellion Lodge Thursday night by 7 o'clock. I was in Pensacola doing some work with an old project there, and I had a dickens of a time to get back there in time, but I made it. They had a plaque and gave me a high honor, man. And whoever did it, my assistant knew my history long years ago, because we worked closely together for a good many years. So I didn't know that. He was assigned to write up my history. My successor, he had no more use for me than he had for a rattlesnake.
Yeah.
He had a master's degree in forest economics. So he was supposed to make the presentation talk, but he didn't. He ducked out on that. And so the chairman there read my checkered career, you know, history, and then they called me up. Well, I was on the rostrum. I went back with some of the younger foresters I knew, and I didn't go up on that stage. I didn't think I belonged there. I'm not seeking any notoriety, but the chairman there came down and finally found me at Baby Cup and sit with the notable, so-called. And then they gave me this nice plaque, and what I got a kick out of was, after stating for my contribution or something to forestry and all that, down at the bottom, the old pine knot. You know how that came about?
No.
That was my nom de plume around the campus, because I would insist that forestry had a place under the sun, and the people that were against me in early days were favoring the cattlemen, because the cattlemen wanted to burn the woods, and they were controlling the legislature, and if they didn't side with the cattlemen, they wouldn't get any agricultural appropriation, you know, and that had that bad angle to it.
Yeah.
But anyway, they would say to me, oh, agriculture is the thing, and burning the woods and raising cattle is the thing. And I'd always come up with some nasty remark like, what do you get out of an acre of pine land when you burn them in the way of return? At good range, you get about 65 cents worth of beef. But if that were in timber each year, if that were in timber, you could yield at least $2.50 per acre per year from timber sales. What's the best for Florida? Oh, that old pine knot, you can't talk to him.
Oh.
So I I got the name the old pine knot because I was incorrigible. I was opposed to burning wood. And that was a cattleman's business. But I came out with a program that beat that. If they'd put in my wide fire lanes and leased that range at 2,500 or 30,000 acres to cattlemen, they would have had successful fire protection, and the cattlemen would have been their friends. And if they had given that cattleman, in addition, roaming the range, he could keep fires down. If they gave him 1% of the timber sales, they'd have somebody that would fight to keep fires out of his woods. And they'd be in a position to keep it out because they were riding the range after their cattle. That was turned down flat by everybody at the university. But again, it was a practical thing. And because I said so, don't have any degree, it's impossible to follow a fellow like that. That's one thing about institutions that's kind of bad. I have a man in my Sunday school, along with the old men's family, a retired agriculture economist. There's a man out in the San Francisco area, I can't think of his name, you may have read some of him. He writes pithy articles, and he'd never been to school. And this gentleman, I quoted something one day he said, because he is sharp. Oh, he said, I don't read him. He has no education. You know what happened here recently? The University of California offered him a professorship if he'd come, but he refused. And I know why. He'd be just like me at the university.
Yeah, that's right. He'd be an old pine knot.
He would be none recognized by the profession and by the teachers. And I'm for education. I'm 100% for an education.
Up to the eighth grade.
But you do need, yeah.
Mr. Nealon, it's amazing what a fella can learn if he goes just to the eighth grade.
Well, I had my eighth grade all right.
Yes.
You know, I used to, when I went west, I used to correspond with my old teacher, a related teacher, the old maid then, that taught the first, the seventh and eighth, and got me through all right.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I went through her town in Bishop, California.
Faye? Oh, Faye!
Yeah.
You ought to check me now, then.
So, I stopped at Bishop at Owens River Valley in the east side of the Sierras.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on the phone and I called her up. She finally got married and raised a family. I said, do you remember a lean little old boy by the name of Louis Nealon?
Just sit down a minute.
Okay.
She says, yes, I should say I do. Well, I said, I'd like to just call on you for a few minutes. And she was just delighted to have me. Now, she died about a year and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
2 years ago. So we had a nice visit, and she made us stay for lunch. And we reminisced a little about my little old school in the foothills of the Sierras, where I got all the education I had.
Yeah.
And this teacher saw me through the 7th and 8th grade, and she married and moved up there in the hills.
Well, what'd she say?
Huh?
What'd you want to talk about?
Old times, mostly. And fortunately, she never mentioned my depredation.
Oh, listen. Not old times, but just wonderful experiences, I guess.
Well, you know, if you live a long time and keep your eyes open, you learn a few things too. But
keep your eyes open is the main thing.
Well, they say to me, don't you get tired driving those long distances from here to California? I said, not a bit. Every mile is like a page in an interesting book, but you have to see what you're looking at. I have to count all the coyotes and jackrabbits and roadrunners and scissor-tail flycatchers. I've gotten so acquainted, I tell the wife, the scissor-tail flycatcher is a beautiful bird. It's going to show up pretty soon. We may not go 5 miles before this one on the telephone wire. So, you know, if you get acquainted, everything is interesting, and all the cactus is in bloom along in May and June. And it's an interesting country, even the desert is.
Oh, yeah.
Have you been out at all?
Yes, I have.
But
not like you.
The first time I went, I didn't see much.
No.
But every time you go, you see and learn a little more. country because when I finally see those blue mountains with snow caps on, it got me.
Then you think that's it.
What happiness is when the car turned west. The hallowed hills are home. That's just a little vacation now. You know, we lost everything we had there. We had a beautiful farm there, a fruit farm, along the main road, dusty road in those days. And then the gold dredgers came in. They bought up the choicest river bottom,
yeah,
the strongest land, turned it into 12 feet high cobblestone.
Yeah.
But they had to float the dredge on water. And
yeah,
the land company that sold all the 30 families in there all had beautiful fruit farms. They turned our water away, and from May to November, there's not a cloud in the sky normally, and no rain, so we had got our irrigation water 40 miles away from the mountains, in open ditches. Funny thing there, that heavy soil, the grass will all be dead on this side of the ditch, but 6 inches away, it'll be moist, because it's running in an open ditch, and you can turn it in there 3 miles away, and you can't tell the difference 3 miles further down the hills.
Yeah.
So when they turned our water away, that just cooked everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to court. What's the matter with the courts when a man's whole investment is lost? It took them 2 years to decide there's a breach of contract. They were compelled to furnish us water. All the corporation did was appeal to a higher court. Dad says we were already half ruined. It'd take the higher court at least 3 years to settle that. We won't have anything left to fight for. And he said there's a possibility of finding some fine print in the contract. So he said it rains enough in Florida, don't need the irrigate. So we pulled up there. They pioneered there and cleared new ground. Our fence is still the difference between boundless wilderness and cultivated land. But everything, I'll stand on the hill, people would come by there and stop and say, you're living in a paradise here, because all the rest, you know, would be dry and the grass all dead, straw colored. So we fought it out there, and I dug stumps and burned out those lighter stumps in the flat woods. And I told Dad, we don't know anything about farming here. I better go to university and learn something about how to go. So he said, all right. I had three brothers. They said, all right, that's all right. I never asked for a dime and I never got one. I hoed weeds at 12.5 cents an hour, and I made straight A grades because I want to get my money's worth. So when I got through, they called me back to be farm foreman on the experiment station farm, and passed up the 4-year men because they were rich man's sons and didn't know how to put the collar on the mule.
Mr. Nealon, you went up here to the park. No, where was it? Where they had the different plantings, different kind of plantings.
Which park is that?
You were just talking about it a while ago. You went up to some place there. And the young man was showing it to you?
Oh, yes, that was the National Forest, the Osceola National Forest.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was up there. I can't stay but a few more minutes. I was up there. When the state forest came in, I was doing forestry work as a county agent because they were burning the woods, and I knew it was destructive down there. And so I organized the first 4-H clubs in the state, but there was no forestry department till 6 years later. Then, when the state forester came down, he heard what I was promoting down there, and he was from Montana. He didn't know one pine from another. Naturally, I don't know anything about Montana either. So he said, if you're that much interested, you should be working for us. Well, the county hadn't paid me for 3 months, 5 months. There was no money in the agriculture fund. My $60 hadn't been paid, but I had a lot of unfinished business. The farmers were loyal. I didn't want to leave them with half-finished programs that I originated. But when the state forest, I told wife, we can't raise a family even with a cow and some chickens in the garden on $60 a month. So when the state forester came down, they offered me much better pay and paid all my travel and gave me a pretty responsible job, a mean job, promoting fireline plowing from Florella, Alabama to St. Augustine.
Yes.
Farm equipment busted down, the wet winter, the tractors, nothing but wheel tractors, they bogged down everywhere. And so I weathered that out. And then he promoted me to district forester, and I had 12 counties in population, and that area up there was in my territory, and I knew about it because I fought fire all around it. The reason I came out with this multiple use program with 8 men and 1 tractor, I fought fire. It started on the Georgia line for 2 days and night without ever stopping to sleep or eat, and lost 70,000 acres. I said, we need something here. We haven't got to control this fire situation. So I came out with 100-foot wide grazing strips surrounding the big blocks of timber so the fire wouldn't get big. Once it's big, nothing will stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had a meeting, a banker's meeting in Gainesville. After I became extension forester with the university, I never amounted to anything in the State Forest Service. They'd given the young fellow ahead of me the promotion that I earned. I could see that coming up.
In the state?
Yeah, I worked 6 years in the State Forest Service. So I came out with that program. They scorned it. Oh, he's no forester. He wants to graze cattle. Mr. Baker was my friend. He's the only one. He said, you fellas leave Neilan alone. He's working on something. But they fired him through politics, and the other fellow took over, and I was nobody. So when the university offered me the extension forestry job, I was glad to accept it. So I've been in that ever since. But multiple use program was scorned for 39 years.
Now this young fellow who is showing those different stands,
yeah.
Mr.
The State Forest, U.S. Forest Service changes their district rangers that are in charge of the big forest every 3 years, and that's a bad mistake. It takes a man 3 years to learn the territory.
Sure.
And find out the problems the hard way, and you can't do that by reading a book. So then they change them and they bring in a new one. But this new one, ranger in charge of the whole big forest, thousands and thousands of acres, he was showing us the new methods in forestry that they were putting on there in planting different species, and in particularly in new strains of pine that were more productive and so on. And the last place we stopped was a big sign up there, and a young forester standing by it. And he began to explain what his assignment was in developing new ideas in forestry, timber grazing and game, the program I came with in 1930.
Yeah.
But I didn't say a word. I just let him talk. But he was mad as a hatter because that miserable thing was assigned to him. Every once in a while, one of the old foresters that knew who started that would slip up behind me and give me a poke. He knew who started that program, and it's come to stay, but it's been accepted now. But as I told Dr. Miles, a principle is of no value unless you know if, when, where, why, and how to apply it. And they don't. How should they?
They've
been in the woods long enough.
You've handled animals a whole lot.
Yeah, I had to.
Never tell you. Can you make a pet of a coon?
Sure you can, and a nice pet, too. Of course, he'll get into mischief, a young one will, so you'll have to be a little careful there. He may monkey with things he had no business with, but he is a friendly, if you bring him up young enough,
yeah.
Early enough,
yeah.
And you can teach him. You can make a pet out of a sandhill crane. Man out in the West Coast had a story on that.
Yeah.
That tickled me. He had some nesting, and the nest washed out in an unusually high freshet they had in the hills up there, and he saved the eggs of the nest that was washed away and hatched them under a hen, and he had a little crane that grew up with him, and he was the daddy of that crane from that time on. That's the way animals are. If you get them early enough, you're their parent. So that crane, he would be around wherever he went on the ranch. If he was 68, the crane was standing there, old and friendly. So he had to make a trip from Oregon down to San Francisco. And he said, what to do with the crane? He couldn't do without him. The crane couldn't do without him. So he put him in the back of the car and he drove down there, and they stopped at a tavern to get a drink, and there was a racketeering man that had too much liquor in him and he was making quite a fuss. And so the man that owned the crane said, "Well, I'll try something." The bartender was all upset. He didn't want to throw him out, he didn't want to hurt him or anything, but he wasn't behaving. So he brought that crane in. The crane walked around a few minutes and let out his crazy whoop. You've heard them, haven't you? When they, especially when they're grown, just young grown, they can whoop it up something terrible. And that man made for the door. He thought Satan was after him. Somebody, he said that crane came in handy.
Hey, Master, one more question. Now, what can you do? Sit down there, man. Will a coon behave if you start him early?
Well, you can train him, but now you have to remember they're wild animals. But if they know what they're to do and what they're not to do, if you bring them up, mm-hmm. they'll do that. Make wonderful pets. They're so interesting, but I'm not recommending it, understand, but people can do it. It is possible to do it and make a nice pet out of them.
Well, let me tell you, did you ever hear of anyone having a pet skunk without altering them?
Without altering them, a skunk would probably make a very nice pet. The only time you have to look out for him, you know the old story of a fellow that kind of lost out fighting people that were dishonest. He says, don't try to outsquirt a skunk. He applied that to people. A skunk is an interesting little animal and make a good pet, but you could get in trouble. If a young dog comes running up to him, he'll suck him just like that. I've run into him in the woods. I saw one approaching at a distance sometime. I sat down quietly on the log and he kept getting closer and closer and finally he saw me. And he took his foot had it like that, and then he showed off.
Mr. Neal, let me tell you. One of Ms. Guthrie said that they was out hunting one time, coon hunting, and it was in their car, Jeep or something, truck, and the light shined on this coon, and the eyes of the coon's eyes.
Yeah, it was like two lanterns.
And he says that coon just stood there and put his paws up over his eyes. And she said you couldn't kill an animal like that.
No. You know, I love all wild animals, of course, and all birds and everything there is. And I'm feeding about 25 or 30 wild doves in front of my yard on the street there because I'm conscious streaking. Out there in the west, there were no butcher shops. The rifle and the shotgun brought in the meat, and that always tickled me because we worked 6 days shelled out labor on that farm. And So I'd rather say if you want any meat on the table, you better bring in some. Oh boy, you get a half day off hunting. That was a whole lot better than pruning or plowing and whatever we did on the ranch. And so there were sometimes have as many as 25 mallards eating a week, fat ones. And wild pigeons larger than our house pigeon that we have here were about 1,000. Doves and quail, snipe, 8-pound jackrabbit, a young one, roasted with cream gravy, not bad eating. Anyway, I was better off than some of the early ones out there. Man was lost in the desert country, and finally after 2 days he saw smoke and he went over there and there was some just about as lost as he was, but they'd shot a coyote and was roasting him. I used to trap him as a boy because the sheep people paid a $5 bounty and he'd take it to the courthouse and he'd pick it up and drop it in the fireplace and give you a $5 gold piece. Well, in those days that was real money. But we were kind of Scotch, you know. We had about 100 laying hens, and you have to have some animal protein for those. So Dad had a bone cutter, and I had to put that 35-pound coil through that bone cutter, and they're much stronger than a dog. You know, a dog sometimes doesn't have his bath at the right time. A larger dog, he gets kind of strong. And I was about half sick by the time I ground all that coyote bones and all into sausage for the chicken.
I'll tell you, Miss Needham, why is we used to eat a lot of beef, and we had roast beef. Now my recollection is that was always tasty. Well, they got better meat now than we ever had then.
Oh yeah, things have changed.
But it still don't have the taste that meat had.
Well, it's something about that. I don't know. Was it pasture raised,
yeah,
like yours,
yeah,
here?
Yeah.
May have been in the food. You know, what country was that in?
Well, that's up the country.
Bluegrass,
yeah,
country growing there.
Yeah.
Bluegrass growing.
Yeah.
Probably made the difference. Wouldn't be surprised. It does make a difference what the animals eat about the flavor of the meat.
Yeah.
But we had deer there too, and you know, venison had lasted quite a while then. In summer, why, you could make jerky out of it. You know how they did that? They cut the meat into strips.
Yeah.
You see, no refrigeration in those days. You cut,
yeah,
the meat in strips and dip it in salt water and hang it up on the clothesline, and then it would keep indefinitely.
How are you going to, Mr. Neal, suppose you have been having all that range, that cheap range, you know, like the Illinois container people have.
Yeah.
And it ain't any good anymore. And then they put that wildlife out there, and the hunters go in there, and if they don't find any wildlife, they'll shoot your cows.
Oh, nowadays things are terrible. Oh.
Well, now, how is just an ordinary person going to change from that woods cow to a pasture cow?
99 out of 100 would fail.
What's the trouble?
What's the trouble? They didn't come up that way. They wouldn't know how to go in time. And by the time they found out how to go, they'd be stone broke.
It's just too costly to learn.
Yeah, it's too slow learning. Grown people don't learn fast. And I'm one of them. But anyway, they recognized me at that forestry meeting, and I felt like the old bottom rail came to the top.
Listen, either way, enjoy the visit.
Let me tell you, here's one thing
that you can't get around. Some of those old people, those people, you know, that used to have the woods cows, were so much better company.
Yeah.
You just love to be,
yeah,
with them.
Yeah.
Now, how you account for that?
Well, one thing is, I think Southern people were naturally courteous.
Yeah.
And more so than Western people and Northern people. And I don't know, maybe it came about because on the range, like in the West, on the range, you didn't see many people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then when you saw someone, you were glad to talk and get some news maybe, and no newspapers in the early days, you know, in the rain just out. So maybe that helped to make them more friendly. I don't know myself. I'm guessing too.
Well, they seem to have, they seem to be able to talk so well. And they can tell you about their experiences,
oh,
and all like that.
Yeah. Well, I've had a few myself. Did I tell you about my experience when we first moved in those flatwoods? That was all cattle rings and wild hogs.
Yeah.
And we wanted a better milk cow, so Dad finally was able to buy a half-grown heifer, a little more. And finally, the thing became breeding age and got over the fence and got with one of those scrawniest, miserablest range bulls you ever saw. And I,
yeah,
told, that ain't going to do. So I knotted up. I'm no great shakes with a rope, but I knotted up 2/3 plow lines into a lasso, and I tried to sneak up on those to lasso that heifer and get away from that terrible bull. Well, here was the heifer stand. Finally, after much maneuvering, slipped up on the heifer side, bent over so he didn't see me, and here was the heifer standing, and here was the bull just about a head or so behind me. And that got me within range of 60 feet of my rope, and I threw my rope, and just as it descended, that rascally bull stepped out ahead of the cow, and I had him instead of the cow.
Yeah. Well,
now, what did I do? I dug in my heels, Scott, you know, I was going to lose those 60 foot of new plow line. Dug in my heels and round and round he went the length of the lariat and couldn't get away. And what I hadn't reckoned with, that rascal had plenty of horns, turned and charged me. Well, that was something that looked serious. And I whirled around and about 60 yards away there was a slender pine, you know, they'd logged it there and left those without any branches. He wouldn't have had time to climb up anyhow. But I beat him to the pine, clompity clomp right back at me. And I never did run that fast in my life, but I never had so much encouragement. So when I got to the tree, he was right behind me. And I guess my mind was preoccupied with something else at the time. I forgot to let go of that rope. And so when he got to the tree, I found out pretty quick the two legs would get around that little tree stem in less distance and quicker than four could make it. And round and round he went. He wouldn't give up. Round and round and round. Always kept 2 feet away from the horn. And all of a sudden he flopped down flat on the ground. He wound himself up on that rope and snubbed him and it caught him off balance and down he went. So I stood over him and I said, well now, if I get my rope back and it'd be after me again, what can I do about it? And I hadn't studied there, lying there rolling his eyes, and he solved the problem himself. He gave his head a snatch like that, popped the rope right in his horn, jumped up and ran away. He thought I knocked him back.
Miss Neela, how did they get along with them scrawny woods bulls in those days?
Well, in those days, an animal was an animal, and they paid no attention. A bull just occurred. But they would castrate, of course, to get steers, but that's about all.
Yeah.
And there may have been other places down south on the range where they were better than they were in Flagler County, but there was no attention ever made of grading up that I could see.
Yeah.
Oh, I got a little in trouble with the cattlemen down there. They weren't all so courteous as me. I came home to a little farm one time and I had a nice little vegetable garden and the critter was in there. Got over the fence somehow and ate up all my turnips and everything. And I tried to chase him out, he couldn't find the gate. And then I got mad and I got my shotgun. And I know how to use bird shot, so well, I chased the critter towards the fence and I knew he was going to whirl around again. I gave him a load of number eights in the rear end. He soared over the fence like a bird.
Yeah.
Which I expected. And just then a cattleman came around the road to a little hammock there and saw the whole operation. Me being a new settler didn't like us anyway. We were taking the range in. I don't blame him. He says, is that the way you do it, stranger? I said, that's the way I do it. I was still mad as I had her losing my garden. I was batching it in those days. So he said, well, what about your fence? What about your fence? Why don't you build a higher fence? It was a regulation height. I said, well, a man's got a gun, he doesn't need a fence. He drove off. So I wasn't in too friendly situation there, but later on, when I got to be county agent there, I vaccinated his hogs and we patched it up. You know, I was the first one to ever vaccinate hogs there. I took a good course in veterinary science here. They didn't teach it after that year.
Yeah.
And so I knew how to vaccinate. I knew how to do a number of commonplace things.
They don't, Mr. Dillon, they don't have any more hogs. Ms. Guthrie Coleman, they don't try to raise hogs anymore. She says the hunters come over there and get them faster than they raise them.
The world isn't the way it used to be. And poor people. I had a letter from a friend in Old Mexico the other day. He had a little farm there, and he had some dairy, and the mice were about to eat him up. And so he got some cats, and they multiplied to 9 head. But he said, you know, I lost them all. Neighbor there, Mexican, and they're poor people there. And when my mice were all eaten up, they strayed over to him, and they ate them all up. Talk about being fussy about your meat.
Yeah.
No, we never got so we ate cats.
Yeah.
But rabbits were good eating cottontails. And so you can't be too cheesy if you haven't had meat on the table for a couple of days.
Let me tell you, these people who were brought up, you know what we used to call, when I went to school, they'd call it subsistence farming.
The what?
Oh, they'd call it subsistence farming.
Oh, yeah, subsistence.
You know, they'd have a little cane and syrup and raise their own hogs and all like
that's
that.
That's what the old-timers did. They didn't have any acres.
Now, let me tell you, the people now, even the ones who are having trouble, you see, making both ends meet, they won't do that. They won't even have collards in winter, Mr. Nealon.
What's the matter?
I don't know.
Has the country degenerated today?
I think it's partly all the young people are gone.
Yeah, that's the trouble.
And then you take somebody who's got sugar or high blood, they call it, you know, they just, blood pressure.
Yeah.
They just not eager to get out and raise a garden.
No, it's something about that. I know there's another thing about that, the old South. I don't think it's as current in the North as one in the West, but they had kind of an Indian complex in those days. It was the wife's job to tend to the garden.
Yeah.
They were out in the fields or out on the range or somewhere. They did a man's work, and the garden there was beneath them. And maybe some of that carried over with some of them. I don't know. But the biggest problem in this country is today, when the family-sized farm left, problems began to multiply.
Yes, sir.
And the
yeah.
children out on the farm had
yeah.
employment, they had
yes.
something to do.
Yes, sir.
And they came up with decent surroundings. Then when the whole crowd moved to town, often they were not well qualified for city work.
No.
And so the mother often had to work too out to keep make ends meet, and the children grew up on the sidewalk and they learned the wrong thing. And so our country is
This barred owl we saw out there, can he pretty well take care of himself?
Yes, he has for half a million years or more. You haven't done anything that would disturb him. He'll keep your cotton rats down. You eat some young cottontail rabbits or frogs he'll eat. He'll eat anything that creeps or crawls.
Once
we used to think out west that the red-tailed hawk, we only have a few of them here, was bad on the chickens and turkeys and things, so we'd shoot them once in a while. We got in range of them. One time we shot one, had his claws filled out, and I said to myself, I bet he's got a chicken in there. And when I opened him up, all filled up with caterpillars. And I didn't think a big hawk like that would do that.
Well, what do you know?
I've often seen them flying over a field and suddenly go down like a rock.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Come up with a rat, a field rat or a field mouse.
Yeah.
So they're useful creatures, and an owl is useful.
Well, you know this little hawk we call the Jayhawk?
What is he? I haven't heard him called that.
Oh,
what kind of hawk?
Oh, he goes like a jay, you know. He's that friendly one that sits on the...
Is it what we call a tilly hawk? He goes tilly, 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 tilly.
No, he's bigger than that.
He's a bigger one than that.
Yeah.
That must be red shouldered.
Yeah, red shouldered. Yeah. Well, now.
He's a frog eater.
Yes, and grasshoppers.
And lots of insects, yeah. They eat a good many insects. So they're not all bad. Hawks, people shoot them too much, and it's not good.
Mr. Bryant out there told me one time, Mr. M.M. Bryant out there.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he was a principal fellow. He said he just shot an old blue darter. And I went out there and found him, and he was one of these little gentle jayhawks. And my experience is that people out in the countryside, the farmers, they don't know anything about wildlife.
Not a thing. It's beneath them to even mention it. And it's sad. It's too bad. And not even interested. I was on the plantation there, stopping on my way west with an old friend who has a big plantation there. He doesn't even want to hear about his wildlife.
If they talk about a coon, they'll just tell tall tales about a coon.
Yeah.
They don't actually know.
No, they don't know.
And they haven't watched them.
We used to trap them in California as boys for the skin, for the fur, you know, and we never got a hold of a dime unless we did something like that.
Yeah.
So we would trap them, but they're interesting critters. They used to come into our grape vineyard and pull down the bunches, and you see the grapes there are all short.
They're pruned down to
the whole plant may be 25 years old.
Yeah, like a little stump.
Yeah, like a heavy stump with a lot of sprouts on. Prune it back, the long switches, prune it back to three buds each. And then that would put them within reach of the coons, and they really rated them. But not too seriously. My goodness, every year we'd have a ton or more of it. Dad was no marketing man. He was a grad producer, but marketing didn't interest him. Could have sold more than he did.
Miss Guthrie said they had a pet owl when the children were growing up, and that they had been out in the woods there, and they had found these baby owls in an old tree stump.
Oh yeah.
Now, is that where they raise?
Yes, they like to get into a hollow tree if they can find one, but they'll appropriate a squirrel's nest or a hawk's nest or some other nest that's big enough too.
Yeah.
I don't think they're too fussy about where they find the place.
Yeah.
The great horned, he'll keep the eagle away. He's a bad critter.
Well, now, you mean they would put the eggs right there in an old stump?
Yeah, they go in there and smooth out rotten wood, make it kind of a bed out of it, and a soft bed out of the rotten wood that's available there, and that's all they need. They don't need a fancy nest like an oriole. We'll see. It's been nice to visit you.
Yes, sir.
This trip is always one of our best.
Well, I'm glad you saw an owl.
This year, you know, the birds are mostly all stayed north. They haven't
been through that high.
Now, Mr. Nealon had to get on in, and I didn't get him until late, and he talked faster and faster. And he'd stand up, he'd get his hat, and then he'd stand up, and I'd say, Mr. Nealon got just one more thing here. And he'd sit down, and he'd stand up. He's on his way out there when I was talking about the owl, you know. Now, this is Saturday morning, or noon, it is now, about 11:45. This, he just gone. And after he got out there, Ajax had to go up and visit with him a little bit. Ajax is 3 months old now, and he just play with anybody, anytime. And this is the 3rd of October, 1970. And this is the Audubon visit. Joe Little is organizing now, and Lucille used to be in one of my Emerson classes. And this is Saturday noon, the 3rd of October, 1970. Channel 1 right on this new reel, and the visit of the Audubon group, first time since our friend, Wally Hodge, and died, and Mr. Nealon came in. I told him I had to pick up a little information from him before he left, and it's 8:15 or 20, Channel 1 right, this Saturday morning, the 3rd of October, 1970, the visit of the Audubon people. The birds aren't here. They haven't come down yet. The summer was so hot, they got the seasons all mixed up.